Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head-on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, good evening and thank you, Douglas. I appreciate that awesome introduction. And just welcome to Breaking the Silence. And here we are just live in Houston, Texas, the most awesome city in our country. Kind of bummed out a little bit since the Texans bottomed out against the Kansas City Chiefs just a while ago. And the first quarter, I really thought, okay, here we go. It's in our hands. But then it ended up just turning completely opposite, and we ended up losing big time, but they had an awesome season. But just welcome to the program, and we'll get through this pain and agony, I promise you, and we'll have a better season next year. But we just have a great program tonight. I just want to let you know that we always try to, in the next 55 minutes, to just give you some time to be able to sit back with a nice cool beverage. I got my diet soda right here, so I'm ready to go, or a cup of coffee, and grab a notepad and a pencil and just start writing some things down. And we're going to give you some steps tonight of how to take some negative events in a life and turn them into positive events. And that's what this program's all about. That's what my webpage is all about. That's what my work is all about, is how do you take all the negative stuff in life and turn it into positive? Because you don't ask for this negative stuff. Now, sometimes there are actions we do. We make wrong decisions, but sometimes just life treats us hard. And abuse happens and trauma happens that we never asked for, nor do we deserve. And coming through that on the other side, we try to show you different ways and steps to turn that around and make it a positive impact on other people in your life. If you want to join our conversation tonight, you can feel free. Douglas is right there by the phones. We have all kinds of phone lines at 888-627-6008, right on this BBS radio network, one of the best radio networks in our country. And Douglas was just telling me just a few minutes ago about how many people are visiting the website and listening to our show and just going in and just looking at all the different information that is out there. So if you have a chance, jump on BBS.com and enjoy all the different information, the different shows that we have to offer there. But always be right here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock for this hour-long program. We appreciate it. Next week, right here at 8 o'clock p.m. Central Time, Robin Coogan is going to be with us, and she is a school nurse, but not a typical school nurse. She has been involved in some things that is going to kind of rock your world a little bit, but she also now is helping solve gun violence in our country. And she also talks about generational trauma. She's heavy into adverse childhood experiences, or better known as ACEs. And she just has a wonderful story, and she will be with us next week. Matter of fact, the next few weeks, we just have some awesome guests. So just keep on joining us. And if you would like to get on shatteredbythedarkness.com, I would love to have you visit on there. The Facebook page, also Shattered by the Darkness. Matter of fact, I would love for everybody to get on there right now and look at the new video that my son Curtis just posted a few days ago, and it's a video on the new book that will be coming out. I can't say it will be coming out tomorrow, but it will be coming out fairly soon. We're doing some different work on it that is going to require a little bit more time. But go in there, look at the video, watch that, share that, like that. Do whatever you need to get that word out for me, and I appreciate it. But just let me know what you think about that. And then also you can get on Instagram. At Shattered by the Darkness, and like that, forward that to some of the friends. And, you know, this whole world nowadays is based on who likes and follows and all of that stuff. I don't know how that works, but we would appreciate you letting people know who we are and help promote what we're trying to do, not only in our town of Houston, but around the country. Before we get started with our first guest or our only guest tonight, I just want to share with you a couple things. And I kind of got this from after talking to Peter on the phone, which is our guest tonight. I started thinking about some things that are life lessons when things happen to us, good or bad. And I just want to kind of start off with this, then we're going to jump right into our guest. But a couple things. You know, anytime you want to grow in life, growth requires pain. So don't be afraid to fall apart every now and then, because when it happens, the situation will open up an opportunity for you to grow and rebuild yourself into more of a stronger, brilliant person that you are ever capable of being. You know, it takes sometimes a little bit of pain to make us stronger. So growth requires pain. Also, in this life, as we go into this first month of 2020, believe it or not, you're going to be learning for the rest of your life. Never stop learning. One of my mentors that I have followed for years and years and years is John Maxwell. And he always says, never stop learning. And you will learn as long as you live. And there is no stage of life that doesn't contain a new lesson for us. And as long as you follow your heart and never stop learning, you'll not turn older, but newer every day. And I just love that. Another thing to jot down, there is a positive lesson in every life experience. A positive lesson in every life experience. Don't forget to acknowledge the lesson, especially when things don't go your way in that lesson. If you make a mistake that sets you back a little bit, or a business deal or relationship that doesn't work, it only means there's a new opportunity out there waiting. And the lesson you just learned is the first step towards that new opportunity. Only you know what you're capable of. Unless someone else can look into the core of your heart and see the degree of your passion, or look into the depths of your soul and see the extent of your will, then they have no business telling you what you can or cannot achieve. Because while they may know the odds, they don't know you or what you are capable of. And I promise you, you are way more capable of things than what you believe you are. Keep digging deep. And only you know any control of what you're capable of. Let's do a couple more. And I learned this from my own life. Negativity will poison your soul. Don't let needless drama. Don't you just hate drama? Oh, my. Oh, boy. We have it at the office. We have it, you know, everywhere. It just everybody's full of drama, and everything's always revolving around them. Don't let all of that drama in life and negativity stop you from being the best that you can be starting right now. Avoid all that drama. Turn the other way and say, you know, I don't care to listen to it. What good is this going to help me in my life and my today? It just will not. And focus on what truly matters. Let go of the things that keep weighing you down as we go in this new year. As you unclutter your life, you will slowly free yourself to answer the callings of what's inside your inner spirit. And we're going to talk about that tonight. So just hang on to that. And letting go is part of moving on to something better. You're not going to give what you truly deserve if you're too attached to the things that you're supposed to let go of. Did you catch that? You're not going to get what you truly deserve if you're too attached to the things you're supposed to let go of. Sometimes you love, sometimes you struggle, and when you learn, you move on. And that's okay. You must be willing to let go of the life that you planned for so you can enjoy the life that's still waiting for you. And then a couple more. Maybe just one more. Let's just stop at one more. Right now, this moment is a gift. The truth is, your whole life has been leading up to this moment right now in time. So as you listen to this guest tonight, I want you to literally be on the edge of your seat and put yourself in a position of what are you going to do with your life at this very moment. And just think about that for a second. Every single thing that you've gone through in life, every high, every low, everything in between has led you to this moment right now in time. This moment is priceless, and it's the only moment that's guaranteed to you. This moment is your life. Don't miss it. Embrace it and make the best of it. Just a few things that we need to talk about and kind of just throw into you as you enter into a new week. And here we are in the middle of the first month of 2020. So I hope you jotted those down and hope it meant something to somebody as they're listening. And I want to let you know that our guest tonight, it's an honor to have Peter Maldonado of Newman, California. And Peter has a story, and 55-year-old, two daughters that's in their 20s, early 20s. He has a life story that is just going to shake your socks off. And then he's going to tell you how he turned this life story into something absolutely awesome. And we're going to let him tell the story. So, Peter, are you there tonight?
How are you, hey, Dr. Williams?
Hey, Peter, good evening, and welcome to the show tonight. It's an honor to have you with me.
The honor is mine. Thank you very much.
Okay. And, you know, Peter and I, we met each other, and I guess it was late last year. I can't remember what month, maybe October, November. I was in Newport Beach, California, doing a conference with Counseling Magazine, I believe. Is that right, Peter?
And Yes.
After I would imagine after I put him to sleep from my talk, he came up.
No, not at all, and
we met, and he started talking and sharing, and I immediately said, "Oh man, I have to have you on the show." So just welcome tonight, Peter. Tell us a little bit what you do, and then we're going to get into a little bit of your story and then just take it to the next level. And we're going to dig a little deeper as we go and just having two friends here having a good conversation. So, Peter, just tell me a little bit about what you do right now, and then we're going to kind of backtrack to your life story.
All right, Gary. Yes. First of all, you did not put me to sleep at all. That presentation you had on ACEs woke me up, in fact. Woke up a lot of things inside of me, which generated me to go up and speak to you. So I really want to thank you so much for that. You know, I want to give God all the honor and glory for giving me this opportunity to speak with you this evening, of course. You know, and part of my journey that brought me there at that convention or the conference there in Newport Beach was part of what I do as a living now. I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. I'm a KDAC 2. You know, I myself in recovery. Right now, I work for an agency in Modesto, California, where we help ladies and gentlemen who are struggling with opioid use disorder. That could vary from heroin addiction to the pain medication, you know, the Oxycontins, Norcos, the Vicodins or whatnot. So what I do is I work in conjunction with our primary giver who prescribes the medication. We have our registered nurse and our MA, and we team up along with our behavioral health clinicians. And we give them the holistic treatment, you know, and basically we're making a difference over there in Central Valley right now. And really, really grateful to have that opportunity.
So that's what you do all day long, is you counsel people that have been or still on dealing with drug and opioids and heroin and things of that order. So you deal with that every day of the week?
Every day of the week. We do the intakes. You know, initially, then we do a treatment plan with them, and then we meet on one-on-one counseling. Varies from, you know, good half an hour to an hour. And, you know, they get to share their experience with me, a lot of their trauma that they've gone through. And, you know, I can really relate to a lot of the things that they've gone through, because I myself, growing up, with a dysfunctional family with addiction in my own family as well, I can definitely relate to them. So there's that relational experience that I can have with them, by all means.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Peter, as we spoke, and of course, after my talk, there was quite a few people in line, and I probably didn't have the ample time, but just a little bit of time that you shared with me rocked my world. And it was like, whoa, this is, you know, that's why I said I want to spend time, and I want to get inside of this in front of now the world so they can hear this story too. Kind of just, you could tiptoe in or you can just dive in, but kind of just tell me what up front got you involved in what you got involved with, and then what was the outcome and how you got incarcerated, and just take me down that journey for a little bit right now.
Well, you know, if I can give you the small version, or the quick version, if you will, you know, what got me involved was basically, growing up in a home of addiction here in Newman, California. You know, I grew up number six out of seven children. I have four older brothers, older sister, younger sister. You know, our dad, may so rest in peace, was a recovering alcoholic, or he's an alcoholic. And with alcoholism comes a lot of the isms, you know, the verbal abuse, the physical abuse, the emotional abuse. And like I said, when I heard your presentation, and I immediately could relate, and I tried to count which numbers. I had like about six or seven of those, and I said, wow, you know, and I never identified with that. I just simply, that's how we lived, you know. But I gradually, as I was growing up over my friend's house, I would see how different it was. You know, our home here, bless my mom's heart, she did everything she could to protect us and to love on her husband. And she, I tell you what, she's my mentor. She is, she should be a KDAC 20 by now. I mean, she understood the addiction process, you know, and yeah, you know, she knew how to take care of him, so to speak, you know, during his episodes and the day after, so he wouldn't die over withdrawals with the alcohol. And basically a typical day for me, I remember, you know, and I didn't realize alcohol affected me, not when I took my first drink at 13, but even at the early age of three. And people might think, at three, what do you mean? Well, every once in a while, my mom will reminisce, and she says, yeah, I remember when you were 3 years old, and you're in the corner crying, and I asked you, what are you crying about? And I said, well, the police, you know, and I said a few choice words, the police took away my daddy, and they took him to jail, and the devil's going to eat him, you know. And what three-year-old will sense and feel that and express that? And it didn't really dawn on me until later on in my life through my recovery that how early alcoholism affected me. And like I said, one of my typical days as a 6-7-year-old going to grammar school, I'd get ready, you know, fix myself, and I'd walk by my dad's room, and I see him just shaking, literally trying to put a little bottle of wine in him so he can get through the morning. And you know, just glance and say, okay, there he goes again, you know. And to me, that just became our norm, you know, aside from the phones being ripped off the wall, arguments, the fighting, the beatings and whatnot. And I, you know, we just basically, that blind obedience that they talk about, we just swept under the rug, and we just basically, you know, what was says here stays here. You don't tell anybody.
Oh yeah.
You know, we basically kept the, quote unquote secret, but in a small community, like Newman, you know, it was about 3,000 people, you know, I believe people knew, you know. And, you know, as far as my teachers or coaches or counselors, to what degree they knew, I'm not sure, but, you know, there was help there to seek some counseling. But basically, you just kept it here, because, you know, what happens in the family, you just keep in the family. And that was that part of, you know what, you don't trust anybody, you don't say anything, you just go mind your own. And so I got to the point where I escaped through sports. You know, I have four older brothers. Three initially were great athletes, and they pretty much taught me how to play and you know, and whatnot. So I delved into that, you know, and for me, it was my escape. And you know, leaving this house was a breath of fresh air. You know, coming back home was, and I even felt shameful and guilty for feeling this way. Like, gosh, I really don't want to go home because I didn't know what to expect. You know, dad either passed out on the couch or he's in a drunken stupor and who's going to get hit and whatnot. And so that was pretty scary as a kid, you know, and gradually as that happens, you know, over and over, you learn how to deal with that. You know, I stuffed at least. I stuffed and I didn't realize I was angry. And, you know, underneath that anger, I learned later on that I had a lot of hurt and a lot of fear,
yeah.
You know, and then was at 13 years old.
Was this an everyday event, Peter? As a child,
this was pretty. That was our norm, you know. Every
yeah,
once in a while, dad would lay off the booze. Things would calm down, but you think it would get better. But it was hard to communicate with him because he wasn't one of those loving, nurturing fathers. And by no means am I blaming him for anything. I can imagine how he was raised. So this could have been generational. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell you. We're going to take our first break, and unfortunately, we had to break up the show. So when it goes into the podcast world, it's easier for the networks to handle that in their networking. But we got you up to almost going into your teenage years and what your daily life looks like. But we're going to dig a lot deeper. So y'all just hang on, and we'll be back on the other side of this break in about a minute and 10 seconds, and then come back and let's finish the rest of this story because it's going to really make a big difference in your life. So just hang with us as we take our first commercial break.
From HCI Publishing that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
All right, thank you for listening so far to our program with Peter Maldonado. He is, and I think uses an acronym that maybe you not understand what that is if you're in the listening world and you don't, but he is a certified alcohol and drug counselor, and he's mentioned that in the abbreviation of that, so I want to make sure you know when he uses that abbreviation what that is. Right now is what he does. But so in your life, Peter, as growing up, you had that with the alcohol abuse with your father, and how your mom was just the pillar for you, the mentor for you in that world. And as growing up, you experienced the trauma of that. So we're in that story part. Let's just keep on going and see where this leads us. As you go into your teenage years, it just continues, and you involve in sports to kind of be your escape out of this.
Yes, you know, and I do recall one incident in my preteen. I must have been about 12, maybe 13. At one point, my dad was gonna be violent with my mom, and I remember stepping over the couch, and you know, at this point, you know, 12, 13 years old, I mean, I'm only about 5'11 right now as it is, but I was a pretty small kid. But you know, you start growing into yourself a little bit, and basically get tired of this, and I remember he was under the influence, and He's by Ray laying hands on Mom again. I remember jumping over the couch, and I remember putting both my arms on his chest and shoving him back and said, no, no more. And at the same time, I'm thinking, what am I doing? This is my dad. This is my father. You know, honor thy father and mother, you know. And so I had mixed emotions, mixed feelings. But at that point, you get so tired of it, and you're scared. You know, there's a lot of fear behind that. And so, you know, I remember experiencing that. And I remember at the age of 13 is when I first took my first drink. And, you know, and growing up, my whole thing was, you know what, I'll never be like him. I'll never be like him. And here I was, you know, delving into the same substance that basically affected my dad and his behavior, which destroyed, or I should say, really affected our family. And so I remember taking that first drink and that euphoric feeling, you know, that sense of, oh, wow, you know, I remember thinking, wow, I'd rather feel like this than feel like I do at home. And I really believe that was the onset of my alcoholism right there. You know, I was able to have that false sense of courage and of expressing myself and everything coming out, you know, that was inebriated, you know, with the alcohol and whatnot. And that's at the age of 13, you know, and my brain's still growing too. You know, as we know, it doesn't fully develop that till about 25, 26 or so. So right there, I started to get stunted emotionally, even more so, you know, with the alcohol. And by the age of 14, 15, you know, like I said, I had older brothers, you know, and they, you know, the rite of passage thing, you know, they would, you know, allow me to hang out with them sometimes too. And again, I really want to stress, I'm not blaming them or anybody, but you know, sure. I take responsibility for my actions. But then I wanted to be one of the guys, you know, growing up with my older brothers, older friends, everybody takes me under the wing, you know, playing varsity ball in high school and, you know, being one of the fellas. I have to believe at the age of 15, 16, I was a full blown alcoholic. I started getting blackouts around that age. You know, we're talking a sophomore in high school. You know, and and to think as a dad, you know, think, oh my goodness, if my daughters were experiencing this, it just made me cringe. However, but, you know, but that's part of my story. And so I started high school playing. You know, again, I escaped through sports. I was a very good athlete. You know, I was catered to, I have to admit, you know, by the teachers and coaches, but the whole time. You know, that secret, that dirty little secret about what's going on at home. You know, there's Alateen out there, Al-Anon. I had no idea that I could ask for help there as well. So, but just the whole idea of, you know what, nobody's going to know what's going on in my house. So I'm going to put up this big old facade, this image, like, you know, I got it all together and, you know, very popular kid, you know, at school, you know, had a lot of friends, girlfriend, all that, you know, top athlete on the team and whatnot. So focus on this so you don't have to focus on what happens in my house. Right. You know, in the meantime, away from the house, I'm drinking, you know, Tuesday night basketball games, Friday night basketball games, football games, you know, and this happened all 4 years of my high school, okay. You know, and very, very, very dysfunctional way of living. My grades weren't the best. I remember getting a couple letters, one letter from Stanford for baseball, one letter from Cal for basketball, and deep down inside knowing, you know, I don't have the grades to pull this off, you know, just basically maintain a good B average, you know, B minus C, you know, because of not putting the time in as well. I mean, you know, I knew I was capable, but I just was just not focusing on that. I just wanted to get by, you know.
Right.
And so, but lo and behold, through my high school years, you know, this continued, you know, the party scene, you know, being part of the group. And so here I go off to my freshman year in college. The summer, I graduated high school in 1982, and I decided to go to Cal State Santa Claus in Turlock to go play some baseball. Coach Bowen there wanted me to go play for him. And the summer between my senior year in high school and my freshman year, I get my first DUI. You know, here I am. My very first car, I'm out there. What was I doing? Partying with the fellas, you know, doing my thing. And next thing I know, I take a sharp turn somewhere, and bingo, I hit a telephone pole right down the street over here. And I totaled my car. First DUI, you know. And that should have been one of the first signs. You know, one of the things when I go speak at every 15 minutes, it's a program of drinking and driving awareness at the high schools in the area here. Is I always share, I had two major signposts. Let me back up. My freshman year as well, I had a dear friend of mine who was killed in a DUI fatality. And that should have been my first sign of the dangers behind drinking and driving, right? And here I am once again. Yeah. First DUI at the age of 18. And so that would have, for anybody, would have made him stop and take a look and say, you know, hey, what's going on? You may want to take a look at what's going on here in your life. And you know, in fact, one of my older brothers said, hey, you know, you may want to slow things down. And so it did for a while, and yeah, I got complacent. And but I never, never really got to that point where I understood that I had a problem. You know, I was in the back of my mind, you know, I still have it together. I know I can conquer this. I know I can control it. But I don't know, you call it either denial or fear or whatever you want to call it. I just didn't come to the point where I was able to surrender that. And so a couple of years later, my sophomore year in college, you know, I get my second DUI. And so, and there's a pattern now going here, you know, again, wasn't able to take a look at it. Throughout my 4 years at Stanislaus State playing baseball there, basically it was just a party, you know, the whole 4 years, you know, and my goal, like any other kid here in the town of Newman and any small towns throughout the world here, you know, you either want to be a doctor, a ball player or whatever, you know, engineer. Me, I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player. You know, ever since I was a kid, I'm a Golden A's fan and just I love following them. And so after my fourth year of Stanislaus State, you know, I had a very good year, made first team All-American there, and I was hoping to get drafted in the June draft. Well, the June draft came and went, and I wasn't drafted, you know, so that kind of was a hit to my self-esteem again. And so next thing I know, I said, well, maybe I have to get a real job now. And you know, a few weeks later, I get a phone call from a Philadelphia Philly scout, and he invites me to a training camp. I said, wow, okay, well, maybe, you know, the dream's still there, you know. And so sure enough, I had a couple of buddies drive me down to College Canyons in Ventura, California. Went there, threw a couple innings, and the guy asked me for a job. I said, what? You want a job? You want to play baseball? I said, yes. So here it is. Now I'm tapping back into my dream. You know, I signed a contract for a Philadelphia Phillies organization as a professional baseball player. And I said, okay, here it is, man. We're going. And you would have thought that possibly could have slowed me down a little bit as far as my drinking and whatnot. But all it did was just alter it during the baseball season. And so next thing I know, I have a plane ticket down to Spartanburg, South Carolina. And here I am, you know, I'm living my dream, right? And so, you know, did well that year and come back, you know, everybody's proud of you and everybody's, you know, patting you on the back. And it's like, okay, you know, now, okay, there's that image, that attention. But deep down inside, I knew there was still some stuff that I never have ever addressed and that needed to be addressed. But I just covered it up with the alcohol, you know, covered it up. And so I don't know if people understand how the baseball business goes, but when you sign a contract, my contract at least, I signed for 6 years with them. They own my rights. And so I played for 3 years for them, and I did well my first couple of years. My third year, I was faltering. I wasn't as effective. My drinking still was prevalent, and that's something that I never addressed. And after my third year, they decided that they no longer needed my services. And then here's that feeling again, that feeling of being a failure again, you know, not good enough. And so I couldn't even tell anybody, you know, my girlfriend at the time, who later on became my wife, you know, I didn't know how to tell her. She was, oh, you know, it's okay. You should be proud of how far you've gotten and all this and that. And that. But I just couldn't comprehend that. I always looked at myself as a failure. And so that's when the drinking even escalated, even that much more. And so by that time now I had to tell myself, well, I have to get a real job now. So I started working for this creamer here locally in Modesto. And this beautiful girl who ended up marrying me for whatever reasons, I don't know, but bless her heart. And so in between that time we get married, you know, I promised to quit drinking, you know, I got another DUI, you know, always setting us back one or two feet step forward. One or two back, you know, and like we can never get ahead. And then we finally got married and we had our first daughter and I promised to quit. And so I did pretty good for about 6 months and I just never really addressed the core issues that I was dealing with, you know, that I was an alcoholic, you know, and I never wanted to admit that. I remember getting the old nudge from the judge after one of the DUIs, and he says, hey, you need to go to 10 of these AA meetings, and I want you to get this card signed. And I was like, oh, my goodness, no, I can't go somewhere. And this is how full of myself I was. I said, what if I go somewhere and someone recognizes or knows me? You know, I was so caught up in the image instead of, you know, getting the help that I really needed. And so I got the card signed off, came back and paid my fines and, you know, fell back off again. We had our second daughter, made another promise to quit drinking. I always promise for the wrong reasons. I promised to quit for the wrong reasons. It wasn't because I really understood that I had this really problem with alcohol. And actually, it goes even deeper. And so, if I may, now we're married now, you know, and our daughters are like 5 and 3, and we're doing well. At this time, I'm working for a chemical company as an account manager. You know, I got up the bells and whistles, you know, the company car, the expense account and all that. And now I have a business card. So now my image looks even better. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm okay. Sure. I've arrived, right. so to speak. Still not addressing the underlying issues, you know, the shame and the guilt and all that. And so we're on our vacation in Palm Springs. We're enjoying the fruits of our labor. You know, we had a timeshare there, and we would take the girls, you know, down to Disneyland, and we shoot down over to Palm Springs, enjoy a little family vacation. We come back, you know, and do life, right?
Right.
And on this particular week, the week of November 4th, that week, the year 2002, we've taken the girls down to Disneyland. We've done Hollywood, took them down to the Lion King. Wonderful. Girls are having a great time, family, you know, just wonderful life, right? And so on a Thursday morning, November 7th, 2002, I had a tea time at one of the local golf courses there. And so I get up in the morning and I leave to go golfing. And the last thing I remember that morning was, I believe, ordering a Bloody Mary in the lounge. The rest of the day was a blur. And basically, I literally drank myself into a blackout. And I vaguely remember being handcuffed and escorted back by a CHP officer, either to or from the hospital, taking a blood sample. And I remember him saying, do you know the guy you hit on the bike?
Oh,
and I looked at him. I looked at him and what bike? And I vaguely remember him saying, you don't remember, do you? And I said, no. And he said, well, he died. And at that point, the next thing I remember, I come to in an orange jumpsuit in the Indio County Jail, wondering what had just happened. What had happened? Where's my life at right now? You know, and all the voices, my mom saying, mijo, you know, please stop. Look what it did to your dad. Look what it did to our family. Look what it's doing to your family. All those voices, friends, hey, Pete, you may want to slow down, shut her down. My wife saying, please, you know, get some help. All this was starting just to filter in right now. And right. It was a very, very lonely, lonely time, but a time of introspection. And that's, you know, I had a lot of people earlier in my life trying to share the Lord with me. And I've always just, no, I'm good. I turned him away and I got this. And, you know, my famous verse was, was, I got this. Don't worry about it. You know, I'll control it.
Mm-hmm.
So next thing I know, that's when that was my turning point, my crossroad, and I finally got on my knees, and that's when I gave my life to my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And I said, whatever happens here and out, I just want to serve you, and I'm going to trust that you work all things for good. So long story short, I ended up bailing out that following Saturday morning. This happened on a Thursday, November 7, 2002, and then we had to leave our Suburban for forensics. We had to rent a car and drive all the way back. And I have my 5-year-old and 3-year-old in the back seat saying, Daddy, Daddy, why are we going home? They're children are collateral damage. You know, they have no idea. We're their universe. We can do no wrong in their eyes. And the whole time I'm trying to process this whole thing, my wife at the time is driving this rental car back home to Modesto. And I'm trying to process what had just happened. I literally just removed the breath away from another human being, you know, behind my decision, my action of drinking and getting behind the wheel. And so, lo and behold, this was in November, as I mentioned, I was looking for places to get some help, and I finally realized I needed to get the help. And so I was going to put myself in a 30-day residential, and next thing I know, I get a phone call from my attorney, and he says, hey, are you sitting down? I said, sitting, yeah, why, what's going on? He goes, well, I have some news for you. I said, okay, well, what more news can you give me, right? He goes, well, they're going to charge you with second-degree murder. And as soon as I heard that word murder, I just flipped out. I couldn't believe it. You know, and I could see I was still in some degree still in denial. I was trying to justify everything. Oh, there was no intent. I looked up the definition and I said, you know, I'm a nice guy. You don't know who I really am. I you know, I was just panicking. And so sure enough, based on a case that set precedence in the mid-80s, they sought to charge him with second-degree murder, which carries a life, a term of 15 years to life in the California State Penitentiary. And I didn't know how I was going to do this. So by God's grace, I was able to get into the residential program. I started my sobriety. I started going, reading the Word, going to church at Calvary Chapel here in Modesto, and really doing what I needed to do. I got me a sponsor, working the steps, chairing meetings, and going back and forth. The people from the AA give me rides down. It's a 6.5-hour one-way shot to Palm Springs, but that's how they get into service there. And it's just beautiful people that I was able to meet in recovery. A couple of them I work with right now, Mike Greenlee, he's been a mentor to me, just always just been there, you know, so I can process stuff with. And so about a year and a half passes, I'm going back and forth to trial, and then lo and behold, I go to trial, and I get acquitted of this, the 187 second-degree murder charge, but I was given another charge, a 191.5 or Section D in the California Penal Code, which is manslaughter by moving the vehicle, which, while intoxicated, carries a mandatory statute sentence of 15 years to life. So I'm going to be sentenced to 15 years to life after I struck the gentleman whose life I took. It was a hit and run. So a total sentence of 18 years to life I was sentenced. And how am I going to do this? You know, and I can see God working in all of this already, mm-hmm. Dr. Williams. When I was convicted, the DA wanted me in custody. Of course, you know, I'm looking at a lot of time, and Judge Cribbs allowed me to go and tie up some affairs. He goes, I'm going to give you a month, Mr. Maldonado. Please don't let me regret this decision. I said, no, I won't. Gave me a little bit of time to spend more with my daughters, my family, which all of a sudden starting to matter most to me now that I know I'm going to be losing them. And so I was able to spend a little extra time. He said, I want you to turn yourself in March 4th. And sure enough, so I showed up. And my attorney goes, you'll never believe what happened. I said, what happened? He goes, well, he's sick. You have to come back in one more month. Can you turn yourself in again the second time? I said, absolutely. He looks at me. He goes, are you sure? I said, yes. He goes, well, you're looking at a lot of time. You realize? I said, well, yes, but you don't know who I serve. And I really believe that looking back now, this was a test, you know. And sure enough, on April 2nd, 2004, I show up again. Next thing you know, Mr. Cribbs thanks me, and he goes, you know what, Mr. Maldonado, thank you so much for turning yourself in again. And next thing I heard is gavel going down on his table saying the state of California remands you to 18 years to life to a California State Penitentiary, and life is life. You don't have a release date until you have to go to an parole board.
Right, and we're gonna take a break right now. We're gonna stop right there. She just been sentenced to 18 years to life in a California State Penitentiary, and after we come back from our last break, we're gonna end up finding out what happened to you in prison, how you got this certification and things of that order, then now how you're making a positive impact on people because of what you've gone through, turning that darkness into light for so many other people. So join us as we come back right after this last commercial break for Breaking the Silence.
From HCI Publishing that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
thank you for hanging with us and listening to this unbelievable story from Peter Maldonado. Just got sentenced from to 18 years to life for taking another man's life while you're under the influence. And so, Peter, you're sentenced into prison. What kind of experience was that? Not only for you having to say goodbye to your daughters, but just to have that kind of life change from being at Disney World in Palm Springs and enjoying the fruits of your labor to behind bars, and you had no life except what people told you it was. So tell me, as we go into that, we only have about 10, 12 minutes left. So let's get into this, jump right back in. So they sentenced you to prison.
All right, gotcha. So, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't share this piece. You know, as soon as I got sentenced, I'm going down to this little tunnel between the courthouse to the county jail, and I have the sheriff in my left ear saying, you know, a lot of good with that suit's going to do you where you're going, boy. And, you know, the whole time I'm thinking, why is this guy just in me, in my kitchen here at the lowest part of my life? But, you know, I thank the good Lord for that, because I was able to pray for that man for, because whatever reason he felt to demean me at my lowest point of my life, I was able to find peace in asking the Lord to pray for this man. So, you know, 13 days later, I get with you, what they call the, catch the chain from the county jail to the state prison, and I'll never forget it. It was such a surreal experience. I'm chained up to two other gentlemen who I don't even know. We're in this bus with a gunner, a correctional officer sitting in the front with an A-14 pointing back at us and demanding that it all be silent, you know, on the road there, on the way there, on the road. And, yeah, a lot was going through my mind, you know, playing peewees here in Newman, playing high school ball, my college experience, my daughters, my mom, you know, everything is just, and I'm thinking, what's going on, man? I mean,
right.
look where I'm at. And so the whole time, obviously what got me through that is just continual prayer and faith in the Lord. And so when I got mainlined at North Kern State Prison in Delano, mainline is meaning, you know, you get sent to a yard, and I was at a level 3 yard where I was in the cell living with another man. I did cell living for about 3 years, and then they ended up shutting that prison down per se for mainline, and they kept it as a reception center, and they asked me where I wanted to go, and I gave them 3 other options up here north, because my family was up here from the Modesto area, and they allowed me to go to CSP Solano in Vacaville, California. And again, this is how God's work is being weaved and orchestrated. You know, I was deciding if one day, if I ever was to get out of prison, what I would love to do, and basically help people that struggle the way I struggled, you know, and like you said, breaking the silence of the issues that and the burdens that you're carrying, so you can get the help that you need. And
yeah.
So I was going to sign up for this course to get certified as an alcohol and drug counselor. My good friend Leonard Brazil, who's an orthopedic surgeon up at Forest Ranch, said, "Hey, I got you. Tell me how much the courses are going to cost. I know you're going to do this. Let me know." And so I said, "Leonard, let me just pray on this for a while." This is in 2007. And so I'll get back to you. And then I got back to him and said, "You know what? I think God has something special coming up here. So thank you, but no thank you." And so, "All right, just let me know if you change your mind." So at this time, 2008, almost 9 comes, and I get my points drop, meaning I go from a level 3 to a level 2 now, where it's lower maintenance, if you will, as far as gunners and guns on the yard. And there's a program that gets offered over there at CSP Solano called the OMCP, which stands for Offender Mentor Certification Program, where the state of California, Sacramento, and governor wants to change the rehabilitation system here. And they're thinking, what can we do? So they decided to train inmates to be alcohol and drug counselors to work alongside the free staff that comes in the SAP program, which stands for Substance Abuse Program. And so out of about 300 inmates, I applied. And then I remember going through the process, still application. It's like a regular job, do an interview, 500-word essay. And sure enough, out of those 300 or so, they chose 50 of us. And by God's mercy and grace, I was able to be part of the program. We got some superb training by Terrence Gorski. I mean, some power hitters in the recovery field. The U.S. Navy's Drug and Alcohol Counseling School came up and trained us. Dr. Mealy, co-occurring disorders, the Dr. Stephanie Brown, the family dynamics of alcoholism, and pharmacology, laws and ethics, and we were blessed. I'm telling you right now, Dr. Williams. Mm-hmm. And so we had to do this study, and if anybody's ever been to prison, it's hard to find some quiet time to study, but you make do with what you have. And so then you have to pass a national exam. And they say out of 50 of us, about 39 pass, which is a very high percentage. And so basically, once you pass the exam, you do your practicum inside the substance abuse program. And basically, that's where I cut my teeth. I was facilitating groups of 18 to 20 men. And in there, North, South, Blood, Crip, everybody set that at the door. And we did some awesome work with these men. I'm telling you, there's some beautiful men in prison who are willing to do the work if they give the opportunity when they get the chance. You know, I was able to do one group in particular called Catargio. And I love what you shared earlier. I wanted to add one about your little points. One group, the group that I ran was called Catargio. There's a quote, and I always use this right now with my patients and even on myself, by Ernie Larson. It says, "What we live with, we learn. What we learn, we practice. And what we practice, we become." And it made me really think about, it's not blaming the environment, your environment or the family structure, but understanding how that's affected you and what characteristics and traits you take on once you leave that environment into different relationships and other environments. And when the beauty of that is you can learn new things and practice those things and become those new things that you want to be. So lo and behold, I got my practicum there in the SAP program, and I have a parole hearing coming up in February 29th of 2012. Mind you, lifers, generally, here's the general practice. You go in front of the parole board. You have no mutual combats, no write-ups, no nothing. You run a very honest, clean program. You go into self-help. You're maybe, you know, got some chapel service. And they say, okay, great job. Come back and see us in 3 years. Next person. And so I remember going through that parole hearing. I remember asking God, just let me be as transparent and let me glorify you in this. And sure enough, I went to my parole hearing. It was about 3.5-4 hour parole hearing, so I could be released back out to the community. And my very first hearing, I was found suitable. And it was amazing. The first person I thought was about Charles. Of course, he's the man whose life I took. And my mom, my daughters, and those who were supporting me while I was on the inside. And I wept like a baby. You know, I'm definitely in the bonus round. You know, I was released finally in January 23rd of 2014. I was able to clear and discharge my parole number in 5 years. I got hired as I came out with that marketing skill of a drug and alcohol abuse counselor. I ran an outpatient program. And then currently right now, I'm doing what I'm doing right now, helping others deal with opioid use disorder.
So, Peter, how many years did he actually serve in the penitentiary?
Out of those 18 years, I was up for half of that. And in totality, I served about 1 month shy of 10 straight years. So when I left prison, my daughters were 7 and 5. When I came home, they were 17 and 15.
Wow, 10 years, almost 10 years. Yeah. Wow. Okay, in the last few minutes that we have, and I appreciate you sharing your story and just so openly, and you can tell by the way you shared it, you're just telling from your heart, and I appreciate that. Yeah. What, as the listeners that's listening, the last couple of minutes that we have, what's some of the life lessons that people from your story can apply to their story that you would love to be able to tell and share before we sign off tonight? What can they learn from your life that you want people to know?
Well, you know, here's another nugget I learned from Dr. Jenny Boyer, who's been a mentor to me. There is no failure. There's just feedback. You know, we all believe that we have to measure up to things. You know, I was one of those people. You know, just because you fail, it doesn't mean, you know, you're a failure in life. You know, like you said, I love what you said, always learn, always keep on learning. That's one of the things. I'm going to always be teachable. And for me, my faith is what really, really helped me get through those difficult moments during the riots where I thought my life was in jeopardy. But the bottom line is, if you feel like you need help with something, don't be afraid or ashamed to ask for help. You know, and that's one thing that kept me stuck in that rut for 25 years. the shame, the toxic shame, if you will, of asking for help and knowing that there's help out there for people who are struggling with either anxiety, depression, drug addiction, abuse, physical, sexual, mental, emotional abuse. There is help, and just don't be afraid to ask.
Wow, that's good. Anything else, Peter? Anything else that you...
No, just tell the people close to you that you love them every day. Just, mm-hmm. you know, tell them how much you care and just tell them how much you love them. Because you never know, anything can change in a second.
Okay, now from just because I think we're only about a minute away, but from having to go, your two daughters, less than a minute, okay. Your two daughters, how are they doing? How did, you know, because we only have about 45 seconds now. How are they doing after this?
They're great. They're senior and a sophomore in college right now. We get along together well. I take them out grocery shopping. We do things together. Their mom and I, she's remarried, but we have a great relationship. They're healthy. I'm always open and transparent with them, and I always encourage them to do the same as well. Thank you for asking, though. I appreciate it.
I tell you what, Peter, I appreciate you being with us tonight, and we may have you back on at another time to get even into more of the details of what you do and how you help people on the other side of this. But thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for coming up and speaking to me after that conference. And it's an honor to have you, at least in my book, as a friend. And I'd be out in California. I think I'm going to be out 5 times this year, and I hope I cross paths with you where we can sit down and have a cup of coffee together. I would love that.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it. Hey, there you go. I'll take you up on that. Thanks, Peter. And God bless you and your work. And let's stay in touch, and we may have you back on here shortly for another edition of this. So thank you tonight for sharing. Tell you what, we want to close out tonight and just let you know, as we always do, no matter what you're involved in, no matter what you have gone through, as Peter's life is a perfect example of that, I want to let you know there's always hope. No matter what side of the cell bars you are on, there's always, always hope. So hang on to that hope and keep reaching for that. And join us next week right here. We're going to have a great guest again next week. Robin Coogan is going to be with us. And join us right here Sunday night, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Central Time for another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless. Have an awesome week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.